Welcome to DevelopLex, a Middle Tech production hosted by me, Weston Lockhart, Ross Bogus, and Evan Knowles. This series will focus on the ins and outs of real estate development and investing, where we'll have the opportunity to sit down with developers of our cities, veterans of the industry, and key people that have over time made a massive impact on communities and neighborhoods. The purpose of this series is to be able to bring a knowledge base to our audience beyond that of what reading a book or watching a how-to video ever could, and educate from those who have done it by hearing their stories, both good and bad, along the way. We feel that historically the learnings of real estate have been inaccessible without being connected, and we would love to open the doors to the next generation of doers, as well as shine a light on how visions of community have been brought to life. We hope you enjoy. This episode is brought to you by Bank of the Bluegrass. It's easy to preach about being a community bank without actually operating that way, but I can attest as a real customer of Bank of the Bluegrass that they are truly in the community and for the community. Whether it's closing a real estate transaction that needs some creativity, troubleshooting an issue where you need a real person on the other end of the phone, or just the simple fact that when you walk in the door, your banker knows your name, Bank of the Bluegrass has you covered. Plain and simple, the best bank in town. Bank of the Bluegrass, member FDIC. NMLS 421548, equal housing lender. DevelopLex is sponsored by SV and Stone Commercial Real Estate, a full-service commercial real estate firm located in Lexington, Kentucky, affiliated with the SVN International Network, which is comprised of over 1,600 advisors and staff in 200-plus offices across the globe. The SVN Stone team consists of experienced commercial real estate advisors in the heart of the Bluegrass. SVN provides commercial real estate services to large corporations, middle market businesses, and individual entrepreneurial investors. Serving the greater Lexington area, SVN offers advisory services for sales, leasing, management, and development of commercial properties locally, regionally, and nationally. With transaction volume of over $400 million, the advisors at SVN Stone Commercial Real Estate have vast experience and deep understanding of all aspects of commercial real estate.
Craftsman Contractors is Central Kentucky's one-stop shop for roofing, windows, siding, and gutters. CraftsmanContractors.com/contact us will get you straight to the form you need so that their team will get in touch about your project. Or just text Steven at 859-246-246. 0108. When they finish your project of windows, siding, gutters, or roofing, you'll see what they mean when they say we build with integrity.
Welcome back to DevelopLex. Today you have Weston and Ross in the Awesome Inc. studio. We are excited to have Brian Wood joining us today. Brian is based in Lexington, but kind of does deals and owns real estate all over the country and has a really unique perspective. Different from a lot of the guests that we've had on. So, Brian, thanks for taking time to join us today.
Appreciate the opportunity.
So let's get into where you're from, education, all that kind of stuff. Give us a little bit of a semblance of how you got to where you're at today.
Well, once again, thanks for your all's time today. Native Lexingtonian, grew up on a farm out Nicholsville Road, attended Glendover Elementary, Southern Junior High School, Tates Creek High School, and then ended up at Transylvania University. So I've been around a long time. How I got to where I am today was I was very fortunate to grow up most of the time with my grandparents, farmers, and our typical days usually started at 4:30 and ended when it got dark. A typical day for me would, during junior high school, would get up at 4:30, go do the work on the farm, then my grandfather would drop me off at school, then have football practice, and then go back to the farm, and then repeat the next day.
Wow.
But the benefit of that was just how my grandfather knew how to instill work ethic in me, which I now can apply to everything I do today. So I've been in Lexington all my life.
Gotcha. And so you graduated from Lafayette and went to
Tates Creek.
Well, I associated because I was in Glendover.
You were Glendover. No.
I was actually in my head trying to think where did he live that was close to my head or where I used to live. But Tates Creek, then went to Transy. What did you have a reason for going to Transylvania?
I ended up staying in town because my father was sick at the time, so I had to stay around town being an only child and kind of take care of him.
Gotcha.
So it was a tremendous experience at Transy, and I graduated with finance and management. I don't think I could have done what I've accomplished without Trancy.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny. I do feel like a lot of the people I know that are entrepreneurial in nature have had a backstory of Trancy, which is just an aside, but just kind of piecing that together. How did you go from Transylvania finance to, I guess, real estate
so
in some capacity?
At Trancy, which was a great school, I was living at the time in a 12 by 14 non-heat and air-conditioned room with a roommate my junior year. And part of the situation I had with paying for school, I had to pay for half of my college tuition. And at the time, which was real interesting, Trancy was running at about $11,600 a year. So I had to pay for half of that. Well, I got frustrated one day about my living situation, so I decided to go out and find a house to purchase. Well, that was the start of my real estate business. And I did not know it at the time, but I went to six banks to try to get a loan. And I got turned down by all of them except the last one, which at the time was National City Bank. And they were crazy enough to lend me money to buy a house on Queensway, of which I turned around and rented each room out to one of my fraternity brothers, and I was in the real estate business. So that's how I got started. And then I just did all the progression, collecting money from my roommates, fixing everything that was wrong. And during that time also, I was doing construction jobs. I worked for another local person here in town, Johnny Atchison, and he needed a cleanup boy. So I started sweeping out houses, cleaning them up, doing all the things that people don't want to do. And I learned a lot about construction. And that evolved into working with the contractors and learning how to do that side of the business. Then Johnny and I partnered for a little time period to build some units. And then by the time I was graduating, I had already started building and optioning lots and building duplexes. So that's how the real estate business started. And at the time, you know, when you're in your early 20s, you still have a lot of great friends from college and you're going to a lot of weddings and people maturing, so forth. And I went to a wedding, a fraternity brother of mine, and found out about a shopping center for sale. I was 22 years old, and I knew that I could not continue to build the real estate portfolio residentially, because I knew from a finance standpoint, you could never get it off balance sheet. So I really wanted to get in the shopping center business. So I found out at this wedding about a partnership that was changing direction. And it was owned by Irv Rosenstein and Steve Collar, two other great real estate developers around this area. And I went to him at 22 years old, and I said to him, I'd like to buy your shopping center, but I don't have the money. They were very amenable and tried to help me out. So I bought my first shopping center when I was 22, and they carried a second note for me, and I was in the commercial real estate business. I didn't even know what a CAM expense was at the time. I didn't know about it. I just knew I needed to grow, and I had to focus on grabbing as much as I can, as much information, as much square footage, as much as everything I could in the area, and continue to evolve. I still had the construction company going. You know, and Wes, as part of today, you know, I think a lot of your listeners coming up or thinking about getting into real estate business or anything else, I think I can kind of categorize these inflection points, I call them. And I think at 22, that was a major inflection point for me. And as I go out through, we're getting ready to be in our 29th year of business. There's roughly four inflection points that I can say they've gotten us. The first one, taking a leap and knowing a direction or path that you want to go, but you have to be 100% in. I cleaned out the bank account. There's a big difference in this industry of being 99% in and being 100% in. And throughout my journey, which everybody's is different, different reasons, different opportunities, but you have to be, the singular focus is 100% in. 22 was a major inflection point. As I continued to evolve and building the construction business, another inflection point that took place, which we all remember, 9/11. Everybody knows where they were when this disruption took place, you know, in the United States. I was personally, at that point in time, sitting in a conference room table at Whitaker Bank, and I was the backup contract to purchase Eastland Shopping Center. And I had to close that day. I was a backup contract. It was going to go away if I didn't get it done. So we were there to get it closed. I elected to move forward. But during that time period, during that closing, they had a TV on. And we saw the first tower get hit. And you have to remember, right now at that this point in time, I'm 20, you know, mid-20s. And I'm getting ready to clean out my bank account again. And I had to make the decision. I'm paying roughly $10 million. And to clean out the bank account when I don't even know if we're in World War III. I mean, I don't know what, no one knew what was happening. But I did know the financial markets were getting ready to close. And if I didn't push send on that button, it wasn't happening. I elected to push send. Sent the money. That particular project was wonderful because it allowed me to go in and bring a full-fledged property management construction together along with a leasing. And that established a full-service company of what we have today. We like to call it full headache, you know, from the leasing, the management, the construction, and keeping everything under one roof to know what your left hand and right hand is doing. And that particular transaction, besides from an operational standpoint, also put BC Wood on the radar of other brokers. Because when you close a $10 million transaction and you get it done during that time period, you know, so we started getting a lot of phone calls. From there, that stepping stone evolved into other areas. From there, we were able to pick up another acquisition when I turned 30 in Louisville, Kentucky, and purchased a couple of shopping centers up there from one family for $25 million. I cleaned out the bank account again, another inflection point. But also, it was in Louisville, Kentucky. So I had been privy to everything in Lexington, so I started to step slowly outside the Lexington community and new relationships, another inflection point. From there, it was just Katie bar the door. We were able to get a lot of looks at a lot of particular pieces of property, evolving in Tennessee. And then the next transaction I bought in Tennessee was a large portfolio of shopping centers for over $40 million. And that was a different, that inflection point was different because it was financially different. It was financially different from using CMBS leverage, conduit loans, mezz debt, a whole bunch of other transitions I had never done before besides going down to a local bank. It was off balance sheet of what I originally wanted to do when I was 22 and keeping that focus to try to keep going. Along the way, made a lot of mistakes. I think one of the themes that came out of the organization during that time period is that a indecision is a decision. We were moving and shaking. We were very lean. Everybody wore a lot of hats. And I truly believe a indecision is a decision. But there's a couple other inflection points. But what are your thoughts so far? I don't want to do all the talking here.
No, that's...
It gets boring. I get really melatonin. People fall asleep driving.
So I think a lot of folks will be curious. You're talking about not just the leap from going
to a local bank, a Whitaker Bank, a Bank of the Bluegrass, something like that, to CMBS. But there's so much more between a 30 million and mm-hmm. those first houses. How did you incrementally, was it a cross collateralization? Was it a refinance? What are those stepping stones?
So the stepping stones of this being a full service operational company, we did a great job with leasing and redeveloping. So it was A, acquisition financing. B, then it was the refinance after we did our job of releasing, re-tenanting, driving earnings, driving that NOI to be able to pull out that equity or more and then continue to roll it in the deal. I just continued to put every dollar, every quarter back into the company to continue to go for the next transaction.
Gotcha.
So it was A, B, and then C would be the permanent debt.
Gotcha. And I guess before I ask my next question, I'll start with just to give a sense of timeline and scale, or just to kind of recap on that. You started BC Wood in at what time? Like what year?
1990. Well, it'd be 1994.
Okay, and that I graduated.
Well, my first house.
Yeah.
You know, I graduated Transy in 1994. I bought my first house in 93, and then BC Wood was starting right, really evolving that 95, 96 time period.
See, and that's what's really neat. And what I think is really neat about your story is there was no, I assume that you took in a lot of information as you went, but you went from house to shopping center. You mm-hmm. went from house hack to shopping center. Was there an education before shopping center of like, yeah, I really like retail outside of just it being multi-tenant mm-hmm. and it's not being an apartment complex? Or how did you kind of gravitate towards that?
I graduated towards numbers.
Okay.
Knowing that I could scale and build a net worth faster through the commercial product type than I could a residential product type, because there wasn't too many. The first shopping center I purchased was $2.2 million. There's not too many $2.2 million residential little pockets at the time.
Yeah.
And also, it's a different part of the balance sheet a lot of times for the banking world.
Sure.
Getting out of the residential presence. I enjoyed residential. One of my projects I used to own was a Patchen Village. I had 40 loft apartments there, but I redeveloped it. You know, Patchen Village was a great story. You know, went in there, bought it from some individuals, partnerships that were splitting up. New roofs, new siding, new windows, doors. I took out and tore down and built that road. I built the Rite Aid, built the Waffle House, but I had to move the road. I did that. Patchen Village was also as I don't want you to give you the impression that everything is hunky-dory. And when I say 99% to 100%, Patchen Village is a wonderful example. During that time period, I was building the Rite Aid at the time. Now it's Walgreens. And it was a build-to-suit. And Rite Aid owed me, at the time, a little over $500,000, and they hadn't paid me. Well, the problem with that is I had payroll, and everything else was cooking, but I didn't have the money I knew in 2 weeks to make payroll. You know, at the time, I'd been married a year. I come home, said, honey, I'm sorry, but we have to sell the car. Wow. No, we didn't make payroll in 2 weeks. We don't have the money. We have cash flow, but we don't have cash mm-hmm. to make this happen. So I took the car and I went and sold it at a discount. What's ironic about that is, so I said that game plan on Thursday. The following Tuesday, I sold the car, had money in the bank, was okay for a while. And then the following Thursday, a week later, Rite Aid wired the money.
Oh, my gosh. Did you go buy the car?
No. No. But I sold the car to make payroll.
Yeah.
And I think what's unique about that story is that's when you're 100% in and committed to whatever your goals are. And a lot of people, that's a little bit different. You all are unique. Every night when you go to bed, you put that head on a pillow, your risk tolerance is X, right? What can you go to sleep with? Because of my upbringing, getting up at 4:30 in the morning, always working hard, I believed in myself and having that work ethic, which allowed me to have a higher risk tolerance. So that's a good thing and a bad thing, you know, having a high risk tolerance. I've cleaned out the bank accounts numerous times. I've lost on deals. So it's not all hunky-dory.
Yeah.
But when you go sell the car to make payroll, that's commitment.
Yeah, it's 100%.
And that, I believe in this world, I know that I am not perfect. And I do know that I'm very blessed to have a great team in my office surrounding me that feels that an indecision is a decision. They know I'm the first one through the brick wall with them when we make those decisions. And to move forward, to grow the company. It's a interesting transition. No regrets to be able to have great people around me and everybody learning.
Develop Lex is sponsored by Rapid Fire Investments. Rapid Fire Investments provides access to off-market, distressed, and discounted real estate opportunities in the Central Kentucky area. If you're an investor or looking to invest in Central Kentucky, check out their website at rapidfireinvestments.com to see a list of their available deals.
At the same time.
So with that, we've heard some of the past. Can you speak to, you know, obviously you have employees, you have a lot of properties now. Can you touch on the scale of BC Wood now, today, what your team looks like, the breakdown mm-hmm. of that team, and what your all's process is kind of look like, and just how much real estate you all own? Mm-hmm.
So to continue our process, kind of a timeline, in 2012, I was very fortunate to continue to build the team by bringing on King Offit in my office. He's a recovering attorney. We brought on a good CIO, Mark Delcato. He's a recovering banker. So continue to build a team. And in 2012, I'd grown the business to roughly about 3.6 million square feet that I owned by myself to scale. And made the election at that time period that I wanted to be able to bring the team and part of the company and evolve. And the fact of the matter is, I got frustrated. We were not being competitive on acquisitions. There was a lot of REITs. There was a lot of other big funds and everything else that were closing deals in 30 days, all cash. And we were seeing the same opportunities. But because it was out of my own pocketbook, it was hard for me to perform that quickly because we didn't have $10, $15 million lines of credit just to be able to go do it. Mm-hmm. So I got frustrated. So we elected to raise our first private equity fund. And that's when, as you know, the transition meltdown and everything else was starting to take place in the environment, and we tabled it. We went back in and looked at all of our processes, brought in new computer software to be more efficient, do more with less. But after everything kind of calmed down, we weathered the storm. We went out, we raised a private equity of $43 million in our first fund, and we deployed that over roughly a two-year time period. And properties that 13 centers that properties that were 80% off market because people knew about our reputation. We began to evolve to be known. When we put something in a contract, we close. We give a really quick no if we're not interested, and we move on. That story resonated with a lot of brokers around the country. So we began to expand in different states, mostly predominantly Southeast. We like right-to-work states. After that deployment period, we raised a second fund, and we did it in a different financial structure. We went back to market in 2015. We raised an internal $16 million and partnered that with a JV partner out of Chicago. and we evolved that into 8 more centers. All these particular type of centers either have a grocery anchored theme or essential based retail. Essential based retailer being the Family Dollar, Dollar Tree, the Gems of the world. A lot of these centers we're focused on. We want to make sure that our shopper that comes to the center gets the best bang for the buck. What BC Wood looks like today in 2023, we just completed in 22 the raise of our third private equity side. We raised a little over $100 million in equity. We are currently deploying that. And the interesting transition as we've gotten into the fund model is that now our investors are more institutional, creditworthy, not only necessarily high family, you know, high net worth family office product, but more institutionalized with endowment type based monies. So we've evolved to that. We went to all those same people on the first private equity fund and we were told no to because we didn't have the experience of managing a fund. A fund model is very intense.
So for the folks that don't know the fund model, the timeline that goes with it, what does that look like from raise to deploy to exit?
Yep. So typically the way our funds are, once you have your first close, you have a year to raise your money. And then that's done. And that's the way that it works. From there, we have 3 years to deploy. Some funds can be structured as 1 year to deploy. Ours are structured as 3. We believe in an evolution of time, evolution in locations, and an evolution of just particularly the marketplace. You know, we might start at the first part of the deployment period and a shopping center is trading for a 7 cap. But at the third, the other tail end of that, that same shopping center or something similar might be trading at a 10 cap. So we like the evolution of time within our deployment side. We can hold up properties to 10 years, operate those properties, and go through that. We don't necessarily do that. We typically start harvesting around year 5. It usually takes a couple of years to get your arms wrapped around it, redevelop it, see what synergies need to take place, and that just takes a little bit of effort. The scale of BC Wood, we have decreased over the past 2 years. We got up to roughly 6 million square feet operating in 10 states. Over the past couple of years, we have taken advantage of people buying everything. So currently we're back down to roughly that 3.56 number. Last year we purchased 6 assets for a little over $88 million. So,
and then you have a fund to fulfill.
And we still have a fund to fulfill. Okay. So we're only roughly a third of the way deployed. But that means with our opportunities, the way we're set up now, we can always bring in a sidecar or another joint venture to acquire and look at larger opportunities. And I think right now, if you're looking to get in at your all's age or you're my age with our history and the way we've gone, I think there's a tremendous disruption in the marketplace right now. Everybody's very concerned, of course, about interest rates. That's the biggest headline. Inflation is right up there as well. But to me, I love it. I think it's the best time to find a deal because nobody else is doing anything. So we are working harder every day to find those off-market opportunities or some of the groups that don't want to put any more capital into their properties, specifically with refinances right now. A lot of people are going to have trouble refinancing their assets. It doesn't matter what asset class you're in, from industrial, from multifamily, including residential properties, you know, single manufactured housing, whatever it might be. Everybody is going to have some of those challenges this year, and I think it's a great opportunity for people who are starting off or want to commit 100% into that business, that path they choose, And I think it's a scary time, but that's when the most money is made.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Moving forward with BC Wood, obviously you spoke on disruption. Are you all changing what you're targeting in this next 2 years based off of the last few and all of the craziness going on with the financial market right now? Mm-hmm. Or are you guys sticking to the bread and butter?
We typically stick to the bread and butter, but what we are giving a hard look at, we're getting ready to do a couple of redevelopments on some of our shopping centers that have extra land, specifically tearing down part of a shopping center and looking at different uses, such as the flex space concept. It's very easy to build. It's very easy to get in and out of. And the flex space world, from a rental basis, has jumped up tremendously to where that's almost some retail rates when you look at anchor tenants. So we're looking at it and seeing it as almost another anchor for the shopping center, even though it's a different use. So we're in process with that on a couple of properties right now. Okay. And the past, as we go through this transition and first started, you know, gyms were just terrible. But now gyms are driving more visitors than some grocery stores. You know, of course, the movie theater world is in such transition. Here locally, you know, we've seen the movie tavern on off Richmond Road get torn down into self-storage. We have torn down some movie theaters and built back Hobby Lobbies, stuff of that nature. We just reconverted a Rite Aid Walgreens building into Feeder Supply. The pet industries of the world, they're on fire right now. Five Below is blowing and going right now. We've done a lot of work with Harbor Freights. We love Harbor Freight. Great use. Done a significant amount of work with Ollie's. Those type of users, discounters, Harbor Freights for the weekend warrior, you know, and everybody loves their pets. Mm-hmm. Those are stable uses within our retail community, neighborhood, shopping centers. We aren't a typical purchaser of like a Hamburg.
Yeah.
We're not looking for big box retail. I think there'll be a lot of transition in that world as well. But with our neighborhood community shopping centers, we're not opposed. We have fully discretionary capital. We can go out and do different things. But our bread and butter is knowing our product type and having a rifle approach to creating the best product there.
Yeah. I was listening to a podcast a few days ago, and it was, I think you just touched on it. It was talking about just some of the disruption in the market and that, but the theme being that real estate is resilient. It might change 5 years ago. You know, people were talking about the retail apocalypse and, you know, now it's office and office is dead. You know, nobody worked from home. Nobody's going back into the office. But what we've learned through those times is that real estate in general is always a good asset to own, but it's just changing and redeveloping and modifying to what people are looking for right now, which sounds like you guys are targeting that kind of stuff.
I agree. We try to hit doubles every day. We're not a big home run player. We just want to keep moving the runners around the base. And I think when people try to hit a grand slam every time, that they're not going to be that successful no matter what type of product or what type of industry you're in. Just steady, Eddie, and that's what the real estate has been to me over the past 29 years.
So to think a little bit forward facing as we kind of wind down, there's going to be a lot of questions after the interview of how can I become someone like Brian Wood? If you were to give somebody advice that's in their, you know, early 20s all the way up to however old, 40 years old, 50 years old, to try to get started today, how would you say to try to enter the industry that you're in right now?
First of all, I would say the one word they need to have is intentional. They need to be intentional with their mindset, their time, and their focus to whatever real estate product type, you know, they want to do, is to be intentional. Surround themselves with peers that are in that industry to find out what's going on. You can read and read and read, but until you have boots on the ground in a particular area that you want to own in, that's the only way you're going to be relevant and find out about what really is going on. I think in our acquisitions process, we're boots on the ground. We want to get into weeds, go talk to the tenants to find out what's really going on with the shopping center. Is there a security issue here? Is there a homeless issue? Is theft bad? Are you just missing that one tenant that needs to be here to drive traffic? But you have to do that on a wherever you want to invest and whatever product type you want to invest in. So intentional is the word. And surround yourself with as much boots on the ground information to help you assess and evaluate what your risk tolerance is. That's the only way to get into it. So when once you do decide, you find that area, you get involved in that area, you understand what's going on, have everything halfway lined up. I said halfway lined up. I'd like to tell you it's going to be 100% lined up. It's not. You're going to have things changing. It could be insurance costs. It could be the tenancy in it, or find out about other issues with that particular piece of property. But it's okay to embrace not knowing. And I think if you embrace not knowing and not being like, I know everything, it's going to work out this way. It's very comforting when I go off and say, I don't know. So you don't have to know in order to make a difference. You have to show up and give the effort to make that difference. So it's okay not to know. Or it's like, I was 22, I didn't know what a CAM expense was. That first year of ownership, what I didn't share with you was, during that transition, I got in my first lawsuit, my largest tenant. That was a long night for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, at 22, going through your first lawsuit's not always a great thing. You know, but it helped me evolve too, to deal with those type of issues. So it's okay not to know. Just know that there's going to be some hiccups, and you got to embrace those challenges.
Yeah. Sounds like you can learn a lot of lessons along the way.
Absolutely. That makes you who you are.
Yeah. So we are a Lexington-based podcast. So obviously your business is not necessary. You're based in Lexington, but you're not necessarily looking at deals in Lexington each day, which is fine because we have listeners that aren't based in Lexington as well. Why are you excited? Obviously you live here. Why are you excited about being in Lexington right now? And is there anything that you're excited about in Lexington moving forward?
I think about Lexington specifically, it's hard for me to get motivated. Unfortunately, a lot of municipalities want everything but do nothing. It's great conceptually with consultants. It's great conceptually. It's going to look like this. It's going to be this. But when you go down there as a private land owner, they want to say this needs to be this, even though it might not fit from an economical standpoint. Because even though they have all the power, they're not spending any of the money. And I think Lexington is a tremendous, great community to raise a family and to be here for all those reasons. But like right now, Lexington has a lot of challenges amongst municipalities from a planning and zoning process to where it's just not efficient. When we go to other communities, we see a lot more efficiencies and say, hey, we want you to be here. Oh, you're going to spend this much money to repurpose a older building, a shopping center. We'll work through your zoning questions or any restrictive uses or anything else. And I'm talking about cities larger than Lexington. Sure. And also the smaller communities less than Lexington. Everybody knows that we have, you know, we set expectations to try to make things better. And it's just very challenging on a local standpoint to get those done.
Yeah.
It's just challenging. And it drives a lot of people away. And you know, yourself, you have a lot of national users, not national retailers. And when those people come to town to try to make a difference, it's even, they're like, what? Or I think it's even harder if you're a native Lexingtonian trying to get things done because you don't have the persona that you know what you're doing. you know, you're just a good old local boy trying to get something done down here. And sometimes people that come outside in seem to be have a more shinier nickel coming here. So it's a there's not much right now. I think downtown has its challenges with everything we've seen in the paper with a lot of crime issues. The homeless is off the chart. I don't see it getting any better whatsoever. We need better policies and regulations and trying to figure that out from a landlord standpoint to where we can protect our businesses that are in our shopping centers. Our security costs have gone through the roof across everywhere, not just Lexington. It is a terrible problem. That, and I'm involved in the community, want to help the community, but right now it's just hard for me. I'm just being...
Oh, well, we appreciate the realness because that's the reason we're doing this, right? We're not... I think sometimes we can get in our own way a little bit and say, Lexington's this, it's all these great, great, great things. But the reason really we're doing this podcast is to, one, raise awareness for real estate people, but two, so that those people get involved in the community and make it what they want it to be. So if there's a problem, we can address it.
Yeah.
So hopefully real words like that inspire people to get motivated and try to change it. So
One 10 in or one 10 out. That's been my focus.
Yeah.
So,
well, we really appreciate you coming on. Incredible interview. And hopefully people can see that it is feasible to become what you've been through work ethic and putting yourself in the right place at the right time.
And having the right team around you.
Absolutely. Thanks, Brian.